Yoshiyanda from Tokyo. Then we're going to have sort of 15 minutes each and 5 minutes for discussion. Then we're going to have a break, a coffee break, and then it's Chris Hammer from Los Alamos, and followed by Imai from MIT in this case. Okay, so our first speaker is going to be John Tranquilla.
Okay, well, I'm grateful to the organizers for my 15 minutes of attention. I don't know about fame, but okay, good. So I'll try to address a couple of the points. Having worked out the talk before, knowing what the questions were, it's partial success, I think, in matching up. So I do want to try to say something about whether stripes compete with superconductivity or how they compete with superconductivity. And we've been studying this in the neodymium doped LSCO system. It's clear that having charge stripe border does reduce TC, and that's not too surprising. If you're localizing some of the charge, that's not good for transport properties. And as Steve Kibbleson pointed out, that makes sense in terms of a stripe picture, because ordering is going to hurt phase coherence in the system. It's not necessarily bad for pairing, but I'm going to try to argue that what's really bad is local anti-permagnetic order, and that's what causes the, that's what's most important for the 1/8 anomaly in TC in this material. Now, this is a case where we have relatively static stripe. We'd like to argue that it's reasonable to think about dynamic stripes in some of the coupe rates, but how do we get definite evidence that they're there? One way we've been trying to get an indication is look at a model system, the nickelates, where we have stripes, and try to see what sort of signatures we have at finite frequencies. So, for example, looking at phonons, in these things. From optical measurements, you can see phono anti-resonances that must be there because of the new wave vector you're introducing. These don't show a lot of temperature dependence. We started looking at optical phonons, which show some softening. There's an optical pseudo gap in this system above the charge ordering temperature, and from the temperature and lack of temperature dependence of some of these things, I think there's good indications that there's a dynamic charge stripe phase in this system above the charge ordering temperature. So, to some extent, I think that has some connection with the last point about interesting quantum phases in these systems. So I've got lots of collaborators on lots of different projects. On the coupe rates, Nori Ichikawa was the student who grew most of the crystals that we looked at. He also helped with some of the neutron scattering measurements and did the resistivity measurements I'll talk about. We've done neutron measurements most recently at NIST. The nickelates, been working for a long time with Doug Buttrey at Delaware. Chris Holmes has done some infrared recently. We've done some phonon measurements at Tech Clay with the Karlsruhe group, and other collaborators on infrared and Raman. So here is the phase diagram that we've been working on over a few years. So temperature versus strontium concentration. This is just for the neodymium 0.4 dope sample, which this is TC. Obviously, the reason we were interested in this is because of the big depression of TC at 1/8 in the system. And of course, TC is depressed over this whole range. Without neodymium in the system, TC would come up like this. From neutron diffraction, we see elastic incommensurate magnetic peaks, and those peaks go away at these temperatures. Now, this is nominally elastic. We're integrating over some low energy fluctuations. So if you look at a probe with a better frequency or time resolution like NEOSR, you see the ordering at a lower temperature. But everything's basically consistent. If we look at the charge ordering peaks, we've only followed the temperature dependence of these and really looked for them carefully. In these three samples, we've seen them with both neutrons and x-rays. And if you look at just the diffraction peaks, then you would say that the charge order is definitely maximizing at 1/8, like the magnetic order. And so you just say, well, charge order is altogether what's driving everything and killing superconductivity here. But you'll notice that the charge order gets limited by the structural boundary on this side, and we think what's special about the neodymium is the structural distortion that's induced by having the smaller neodymium ion in there, substituting for lanthanum. And so we're limited by this transition in the diffraction, but we were inspired by some of the NQR work from Takashi Imai's group, which we'll hear about later, and it would have been nice to hear that first, but anyway. They see a wipeout effect that correlates with the charge order in these samples, and from his work and I think from what Chris Hamill's going to talk about, that wipeout effect is probably an indirect measure of the charge order coming from slowing of the spins, but still it's a measure of the charge order, and their results suggest the charge ordering keeps going up even into the LTO phase. Not only that, they see it in samples without neodymium. It's there in LSCO too. So we wanted to check this. And Nori had measured the in-plane resistivity. He's also measured the C-axis resistivity in these samples. But this is the in-plane resistivity versus temperature just for the neodymium dub samples. The question is how to analyze this. Actually, one of the referee criticisms we got early on was that we were claiming to see charge order in the system, but where was the big anomaly in the resistivity? There ought to be a big gap opening up, which you don't see. Now, we have looked at the resistivity, and I'm going to show you we can find a signature that correlates with the charge ordering. It's a subtle effect because this isn't a simple charge density wave system. So to identify that, I fit a linear part to the high temperature features, high temperature range, 250 to 300 K going through rho equals 0 at 0 temperature. And that describes things reasonably at high temperature. And I divide that out. So after dividing by this linear part, you can see now the deviations from linear all show an upturn in all of these samples. The upturn varies with doping. So that's one temperature scale is where the upturn is. Another feature is the rate of upturn varies in these samples. And actually, the fastest upturn is for 0.15, not 0.12. 0.12 is down here. So I need to identify a temperature scale towards which this is diverging, and also an upturn temperature. And if I just choose these values to give a nice scaling result, this is how things scale. And in fact, I found a simple function that describes this well. So I just use that function as a fitting function to determine these parameters to try to be as non-subjective as possible in choosing them. It turns out that these upturn temperatures correspond very well with the NQR wipeout temperatures. But to show you how that varies and part of the significance, let me say something about the structural distortions in the system. Bernd Buchner and collaborators showed some years ago that the size of the lattice distortion in the LTP structure scales with the orthorhombic splitting in the orthorhombic phase just above the structural transition. So this provides a measure of the lattice distortion that we think is pinning the stripes. And if you look at that distortion, this is what we've measured in our neodymium doped single crystals. This is from Radelli and Jorgensen, and it varies linearly with strontium concentration. If we plot the upturn temperatures and the NQR wipeout temperatures versus this measure, we see there's, at least for the larger distortions, roughly a linear correlation here. There's good agreement between the upturn temperatures from resistivity and the NQR. And they both seem to collapse onto approximately the same curve when we do it versus distortion. So this suggests that, indeed, it seems to make sense that the charge ordering temperature is going up as we underdope, and the charge ordering is related to the size of the distortion. It's reasonable. That means that the feature here that correlates with the depression of TC is the magnetic order, which shows the maximum here. So So I'd like to argue that just having the charge stripes in the system isn't enough to kill superconductivity. What's really bad is local anti-magnetic order. And since there's not a lot of time, we can discuss why that might be possible. Other people have suggested, at this point, you can imagine the stripes being separated by three-leg ladders, which should order for any finite coupling between them. I've argued that having the static spin density wave part is bad for superconductivity, and the president of the University of Toronto is going to show some results on oxygen doped lanthanum copper oxide that show a static spin density wave component and also superconductivity with a much higher transition temperature and correlations in the ordering temperatures. So what I've claimed would be inconsistent with that data if the static spin density wave and the maximum of the superfluid density are in the same layer. So if all the layers are uniform, there's an inconsistency. So just to keep things lively, I would argue that I don't think the data are inconsistent with having inequivalent layers in the system. And crystallographically, there are two sets of inequivalent layers. So I don't think there's necessarily an inconsistency with the results. Okay, so in the nickelate, here are some results for a strontium 0.25 doped sample. This is the stripes are rotated in the nickelate compared to the cuprate. They're rotated 45 degrees. They're diagonal stripes. We lose the charge ordering with neutrons at about 150 K, although the signal may just get weak and be hard for us to see. But from the optical conductivity over a big frequency range, you see more or less a gap showing up in the system at low temperature, and this gap goes away as you warm up. If you blow up this low frequency range, what my collaborators found is that there's this very strong phono anti-resonance that shows up
in-plane conductivity.
In-plane conductivity.
Well, phonons are huge. That means the electronic component is small.
Yeah, you can. This is. You can see the conductivity's peaked out about an EV, and there's a gap down at low temperature. Now, this isn't surprising. This is much better. The charge ordered in a much stronger way. So I'm not arguing that this gap is like anything in the cuprates. But there must still be some conductivity around because we've got a phonon that's interfering with conductivity in the background. This is also a phonon mode that's not allowed in the undoped system. So the average symmetry of the sample would not allow this phonon to be optically active. It's got to be from the charge ordering that we get a new phonon allowed at Q equals zero. Now, Chris Holmes has done similar measurements on an oxygen doped nickelate sample. He's seen two modes. This is essentially the same one as in the strontium doped sample. There's another one that shows up here. One feature he sees is that these change from being destructive interference to constructive interference at low temperature, but this is also changing as the conductivity drops. There's no shifting of these. This is just temperature dependence of the conductivity underlying the phonons. Again, you can. This is over a bit bigger range. Now, I'm not used to wave numbers, but this is about half an EV, and this is about one EV out here. You can see that as the gap opens up, you're certainly shifting this weight up to high frequency, but you're shifting it over a huge energy range compared to temperature. But another thing you see is that at room temperature, which is approximately where the charge order goes away from our recent X-ray measurements, there's still a big gap in the system. And actually Katsufuji has looked at, he did the first measurements on the strontium 1/3 case. He went to twice the charge ordering temperature in that one, and there's still something of a gap in the system. So it's not turning into a metal. The ordering isn't just happening at the structural transition temperature. And you see these phono anti-resonances are not strongly sensitive to the static charge order parameter in the system. So that suggests there's still something dynamic around in the system at high temperature, even when the static order goes away. Okay, I'll just about make it. So this doesn't show up especially well. But we've started to do some phonon measurements on a single crystal, abstract clay. So this is energy as a function of Q from zone center to zone boundary, looking along the 110 direction, which would be along this direction in the lattice. The dark circles are supposed to indicate the nickel center. Well, they don't have to be nickel center, but this is the strike period here. It's a three lattice spacing period. We're looking at high energy. This is about 80 millivolts, the mode that we're looking at, and this is a mode that involves mostly bond stretching motions of the oxygen. What we see at zone center is a nice, well-defined mode. In the undoped system, what Pinchovius and Reichardt have seen is a branch that comes across without dispersing or maybe dispersing up a little bit. What we see with stripe border is that we keep about half of the weight staying up here, but another part disperses down and is softened by about 20% at the zone boundary. The phono anti-resonance that's been seen, the upper one, is at about this energy, so it makes sense that there, at least some of this weight is in the direction of the modulation. The lower mode is in a branch that's down here that we haven't studied. We don't see any big dispersion anomalies, but we have to look more carefully to see if there's any line width anomalies. We didn't have this is measured at 12K. The charge ordering temperature is about 240K in the sample. We went to 250K, measured here and here. And there's no significant change. We still have basically one well-defined peak here, and things are broad here, which suggests that high energy, the phonons don't know about the change in the order. So I think this is useful in two ways. This is giving us our first indications of what, in a non-controversial system, hopefully, what the phonon response is to stripe order. And this shows some similarities to some of the features that are seen in a number of the cuprates. It also suggests that the nickelates may not be a boring system. There may be a dynamic stripe phase at high temperature there. That's what I was going to say here. And I've argued that it's in the cuprates that it's the local magnetic order that's really bad for superconductivity and charge stripes. Charge stripe order isn't good. You'd rather have them fluctuating, but they're not incompatible with superconductivity. So I'll stop there.
In the neodymium cuprate, when you see the charge ordering appear, when you see the charge ordering peaks appear, is there a clear, can you correlate the development of the pseudo gap phase at that point?
I don't think we have data. We Dimitri or someone would have to do optical. On the neodymium doped?
Yeah, there is no virtually no change.
Can you speak up?
There is virtually no change in the in-plane optical conductivity at the phase.
But do you see what you would call a pseudo gap existing at that temperature? And what?
You see something like that well above charge
ordering. So you see it turn on well above the charge ordering temperature, and it doesn't change significantly at the ordering temperature.
I will show data for the spin gap on the rare recovery of the brains. It's actually very sensitive to whole gap. The large spin gap component is only done at 4.5.
Sure. No, that's not required. Well, you can at least imagine, well, example, it's not true at higher temperatures. So, right? When the ordering first occurs, we've got charge ordering occurring first. There's no static magnetic order, and at a lower temperature, the static order occurs. We could imagine that if the quantum fluctuations were big enough, you'd get no static magnetic order, but you could still have the charge order in the system. In the nickelates, we also see the charge order setting in at a higher temperature and the magnetic order at a lower temperature. Now, you could argue that the reason the spins are ordering at a lower temperature is because quantum fluctuations are already important. But it's not necessary. As an experimentalist, at least, I can imagine a model in which I could have charge order and break the system into two-leg ladders that want to have singlet correlations and choose not to order.
Of course, that's compatible.
Right. If you could break things into even-leg ladders, then you could have a spin gap in the system. And if the coupling were, well, since it's been brought up, maybe I'll show the work of others. So some of the people here have been involved. Castroneto and Hone first considered a model of coupled spin ladders, and that's been studied more by Vonnen's group, and Young-Jun Kim and Bob Birgeneau have done calculations. And if you take, this is ordering temperatures as a function of the effective coupling between the ladders, and no matter how weak the coupling gets, if you have three-leg ladders or one-leg ladders, you'll always get ordering at low temperature. But if you have two-leg ladders at low enough coupling, you'll get a quantum disordered phase. And Young-Jun Kim has shown in four-leg ladders, it's the same result, but this, I think this gets pushed down a little bit to lower couplings.
Did you have enough information about the magnetic ordering to know whether it strikes, in the geodymium, where the strikes are forming an anti-domain boundary from one magnetic region?
Oh, it's certainly forming anti-phase boundaries because the incommensurate splitting of the magnetic peaks is half of the splitting of the charge order peaks. So it means that the magnetic period is exactly twice the charge period.
You show some nice data where you simplify that the sample of CC becomes insulated. Is there an example where the CC saturates?
Maybe Yoichi will. I mean, the magnetic resistivity in a magnetic field saturates.
Neodymium, for example, still has a PC of maybe 4K.
Yeah, something.
And we need high field to suppress it because of the thing. And the data is not yet reproducible. I made two samples, and one sample was suppressing, and the other didn't. So the case is not clear.
Okay, let's thank John again. Our next speaker is Bob Birgeneau, who is in Toronto, I saw. And he will talk to us about neutron scattering. So.
So I also want to thank the organizers, especially for conceding that someone who does administration still may have something to say about physics. But by the end of the talk, you may concede. No. As I think everybody knows, most people here know, we have had for the last decade a very elaborate collaboration on neutron scattering studies of the copper oxides, especially the lanthanum copper oxide system. And today I'm going to show you some recent, mostly unpublished results, second part, by Kazu Yamada and Masaki Fujita, and by Young Lee, who's now at NIST and may someday be back at MIT. These are a few of the principles that Su Hung Lee, Genshirani, continues to be our leader. That's Wakimoto, who discovered the transition diagonal stripes, which I'm about to show you myself, of course, and that's Kazu Yamada, the famous Yamada plot. I think, as many of you know, also the phenomenology of the incommensurate spin structures in the lanthanum copper oxide system is extraordinarily rich and getting richer all of the time. One thing I should emphasize is that, especially seeing Patrick Lee in the audience, is that I may use the word stripe, but what we measure is a sine density wave in the spins. Okay, so whenever I say stripe, I really mean a spin density wave, one-dimensional, usually one-dimensional. Okay, so that's technically important. Just thing I want to mention, which is really a warning for interpreting neutron data. These are some old data on crucible-grown samples by Bernhard Keimer as part of his thesis in the early 90s. And you see here, in a 4% sample, a beautiful commensurate signal. With float zone samples, we now know that actually that's a very well-developed stripe structure, even though you think you see the peak at the commensurate position. And in fact, it's because disorder pins the stripes and you end up getting an average commensurate response. So the fact that someone sees a commensurate signal does not mean that you do not have a stripe structure there. It may be connected with disorder. And we've actually now gone back and shown that we can, just by simple broadening, we can explain the profiles in great detail with the stripe structure on these actual samples. Okay. So first thing I'd like to do is just to remind you of Kazu Yamada's very beautiful experiment in which he looked carefully in traveling solvent floating zone crystals at the incommensurability across the superconducting region. And so Kazu looked at the low energy, by Kazu, him and the set of us, looked at the low energy spin fluctuations. This is really obnoxious. Looked at the low energy spin fluctuations in a series of crystals which span from the underdoped to the overdoped region, and you see you get well-defined incommensurate peaks. They have this fourfold geometry, which corresponds to the geometry that John Tranquato showed us. And from the point of view of the discussion here, so these are dynamic fluctuations. We'll later look at the static aspect. And one thing I want to emphasize is that these incommensurate spin fluctuations persist almost all the way to the end of the overdoped region. So we've heard some things here about crossovers, and at least in lanthanum copper oxide system, it just isn't true, that the incommensurate spin fluctuations persist throughout. And if you integrate, the weight's actually not very different. So at least in the lanthanum copper oxide system, then there isn't a crossover as you go over here in terms of the microscopic spin fluctuation phenomena. Okay. Then Yamada, of course, produced this plot, which Steve and Dick Emery in particular love because it saturates at an eighth. So this is the incommensurability as a function of doping. At that time, when Kazu produced this, we thought that this was a commensurate-incommensurate transition, and that's how we discussed it. That turns out to have been incorrect. And that's because these early samples corresponded to a pinned diagonal stripe phase, as I'll show you in great detail now. Okay. Then, as you know, there are various models for this incommensurate spin fluctuations in the superconductors, one limit being the stripes of spin and charge, and one being purely Fermi surface effect. Okay. One of the things that certainly convinced me early on that stripes and superconductivity were intimately related, if not in a causal sense, at least they were intimately connected, is that in the lanthanum copper oxide system with a huge number of samples, if you manage to make the samples with a clean, then you end up having TC scale linearly with the incommensurability, with the inverse period of the spin density wave right up to optimal doping. And that would be remarkable if it's a pure coincidence. That doesn't mean that one drives the other, but it certainly says to me that the incommensurate spin fluctuations and the superconductivity are intimately connected, related to each other. Okay. Now, actually, the very day that picture was taken at NIST that I showed you with myself and Wacky Moto, et cetera, Wacky and Gen made this remarkable, what I consider to be a remarkable discovery. So what Wacky did for his thesis was, in part, to go back and repeat Bernhard Keimer's thesis only in traveling solvent floating zone crystals. So he looked at the spin glass region in great detail. And if you look at the macroscopic properties of the sample, magnetization, instead of the spin glass properties, then wacky samples look identical to Bernhardt's. So the impurities did not affect the macroscopic susceptibility or et cetera properties. But when you look microscopically after a lot of work, instead of seeing the commensurate response that Bernhardt and I saw, then in fact, he sees very beautiful incommensurate peaks. And it took a while to get this straight because, first of all, it turns out it's two peaks rather than four. That's crucial because that means this is really a one-dimensional density wave, not a two-dimensional density wave. And for us, that was I think, the first time that's actually been explicitly demonstrated that this corresponds to quote-unquote stripes, and they're oriented in a particular direction, so that the stripes run along the rotation of the copper oxide octahedra. If you then actually go out of the plane, then what you find is you find very weak correlations perpendicular, which means that this is basically a two-dimensional spin density wave with only very weak order in the third direction. Okay. If you look at the onset of this static stripe order, then it looks something like this as a function of temperature. So there's a freezing into this diagonal stripe state at low temperatures with temperature dependencies that look something like this. I must say, this is, you know, in perfectly localized charges what the stripe structures would look like in 5% and 6%. And since we know that these spin density waves persist all the way down to 2%, we should multiply the spacing by 2.5. So that's one of, I think, the interesting questions which I would have liked to have seen up here, which is how could you possibly have stable, why would an insulator with 2% holes ever organize itself this way with the charges lined up densely 40 lattice constants apart? That's a miracle. Okay, so we at least have to think about it.
Well, you just said it was a sine wave.
Okay, right. Right, so that, okay, you're right. Fine. I still think it's amazing to have that large period. But what I'd like to show you now very quickly is some unpublished work in which Masa Fujita has grown a series of crystals in which he goes from 0.05 to 0.07 at steps of 004. So this, I think in the ITC problem, has to be the finest set of steps that have been done to date. This shows the Meissner response, field-cooled response, I should say, in these samples, and 0.053 is insulating. There's the first hint of superconductivity in 0.056. 0.06 is superconductor, 0.07 is clearly a superconductor. And if you look at TC and you compare them with previous results by Takagi, and actually Burton backlog was probably part of this, then you see that Fujita's crystals match Takagi's extremely well in terms of the TC. Okay, so this is now very beautiful because now we can look at the diffraction at the so-called stripe structures going from 0.053 to 0.06 and going from something that's insulating to something that's superconducting. Very small change in hole concentration. And so first of all, in 0.05, Fujita confirms that you get exactly the structure that you had that Wakimoto found, which is diagonal stripes. 0.053, they move in very slightly. And they're still at 0.06, where it's become superconducting, there's still some remnant of the diagonal stripe structure. Yeah. Tenth of a millielectron volt. Okay. And this now shows 0.06, and in fact, in the 0.06 sample, then you get a mixture of diagonal and collinear stripes. Okay. Right, both are present, and the diagonal stripe dominate. That's also true in the 0.056 sample, and not true, let's see if he shows it here. Right, not true in 0.07, and not true in 0.053. So let me now say this carefully, because I just gave you a lot of information. 0.053, which is insulating, has diagonal stripes. 0.056 and 0.06, which is where the onset of superconductivity is, has a coexistence of diagonal and collinear stripes. And 0.07, which is a clean superconductor, has only collinear stripes.
And we're looking at magnetic scattering.
Yes, pure magnetic scattering. and one peak, these are sine density waves. Okay. So this demonstrates, I think pretty convincingly, that the insulator superconductor transition is a first order transition that coincides with the first order transition from collinear to, from diagonal to collinear stripes. Okay, I think it's a magnificent experiment by Fujita. And so, again, they both may have the same driver, but for my sort of simple-minded way of thinking, if I have a first-order phase transition from diagonal to collinear stripes, and that and that drives the transition from insulating to superconducting, I have to believe there's some content, some physics content in the microscopic stripe structure.
And remind us of the filling?
0.058. Okay.
Sorry, when you're filling in the stripe?
Oh, it's about, well, actually, that's a problem, as Patrick may point out in questions afterwards. So let me, if you look, actually, the incommensurability, okay, as a function of running concentration, right, then an amazing thing is that the incommensurability goes smoothly through this first order boundary, which requires a jump in the whole concentration. So that corresponds to a constant line density, constant density per unit length of charge in a stripe model. But in fact, the charge per copper jumps discontinuously from 0.07 to 0.0, from 0.7 to 0.5. Okay, right. So let me repeat that, because that was an important statement. Within the context of a simple stripe model, right, the incommensurability goes smoothly through the insulator to superconductor transition. Right, and you can see with this extraordinarily fine detail because of this, I think, really terrific job Fujita has done. Here in the model stripe structure, that corresponds to a hole in every second copper. And in this model, it turns out to be 0.7 holes per nickel, per copper, pardon me, okay, on this side. Right. The charge density per unit length is a constant through here, right, according to that. I mean, given that this is a strongly first-order transition, I think it's an amazing fact that the incommensurability goes, you know, continuously and smoothly through this rotational transition, and which is also the insulator to superconductor transition. Well, because we see coexistence of the two over a very narrow range, and because the stripes don't rotate continuously. That was the other possibility.
But that's
what it is. So then it's a first order transition. Otherwise, as you changed, you would have seen the stripes rotate continuously. In a continuous transition, you would have gone continuously from diagonal to collinear stripes. Okay? Right? Fujita is brilliant, but not that brilliant. Okay, to give you some characteristic temperatures and energies, this is the magnetic freezing temperature as a function of concentration, and you see it come down and then goes up and add an eighth. The magnetic transition temperature coincides with the superconducting transition temperature at an eighth. Okay, and if you look at correlation lengths, then it's interesting that there's a precursor in the correlation length for the insulator to superconductor transition. So the diagonal stripes become progressively less correlated as you approach the superconducting boundary. And when it goes superconducting, then suddenly they correlate well, and actually they become a crystal here.
That makes it seem more secondary.
Correct. So there's an interesting mixture of first and so this is precursor, right, phenomena.
Pardon?
Oh, these are quite insulating. Apples. I mean, they show variable range hopping when you get down to low enough temperature. Okay.
On the way up.
I don't know that. At 0.04, we've done well and shows variable range hopping. Okay, at low enough temperatures. Obviously, it would be an interesting thing to do sub Kelvin, right? Measurements and these. Okay, let me just jump and say very quickly. For Tranquada, already gave the introduction to this. One of the other systems that we've looked at in great detail. This is Young Li's thesis and continuing work is to look at excess oxygen, dope, lanthanum, copper oxide. Our motivation in the beginning for working on this, which I think has turned out to be the correct motivation, and we got lucky, was that because the oxygens are mobile, we felt that these systems would show annealed rather than quenched disorder, and so that they would be much cleaner than all the other systems you've heard about so far. So our view was we were likely to get the cleanest superconductors possible in the excess oxygen left in copper oxide. And it is true that they are annealed rather than quenched, and actually you can even prepare it with the oxygens either ordered or disordered depending on the history. So I'm going to show you data from the most ordered oxygen, and therefore the least disordered superconductors. And I think we already got a precursor for that, John Polnus. What happens is that when you, it's quite interesting, when the oxygens are ordered, TC moves up by about 10% from that with strontium doping. And if you disorder the oxygens, it comes down, and TC is exactly that for strontium doped. Okay, so you can actually demonstrate TC goes up when you have an annealed sample. And when you have an annealed sample, you get a very nice Meissner fraction. And then, as Young Li discovered, when you do neutron diffraction, lo and behold, you discover that there's a spin density wave transition, and that you get magnetic long-range order with resolution-limited peaks. So this is not a glass phase, this is a crystal phase, magnetic crystal phase, with ordering that's close to an eighth, and with sine wave order actually perpendicular to the layer. And if you then plot magnetic order parameter as a function of temperature, then you find that indeed, quite quantitatively, that the magnetic ordering, magnetic phase transition coincides with the superconducting transition. And I remind you, these are the most ordered samples. So you can see why I come to the opposite conclusion from what John Frankwater came to, right? Because his samples are highly disordered and superconductivity is suppressed by the magnetism. Our samples are highly ordered and superconductivity is enhanced along with magnetism. Okay. So it's the exact opposite conclusion. I obviously think it connects with the degree of order in the system, and I'll just say that was our motivation for beginning research on these materials in the first place. Okay. And it's a mean field transition. The fact that BCS is, I think, not important. In fact, its mean field, I think, is extremely interesting, because I don't know how many two-dimensional phase transitions I've studied in my life, and too many. And this is the only one I've ever seen that's mean field. Okay. Close to optimal doping. Let me keep going. It turns out that the peaks are so sharp, you can do really elegant diffraction on them. And it turns out that these so-called collinear stripes that we've all drawn, it's not precisely correct. And if you believe it, the spin density wave is actually rotated by 3.1 degrees with respect to the copper oxygen axis. And in lanthanum and strontium 0.12, they're rotated by 2.9 degrees, and we know that number precisely. So the stripes have to have kinks every 20th step or something like that, okay, if you believe in the stripe picture. And that's true in all of the samples where we have well-developed correlations. We can do the diffraction well enough to get the very precise direction that the density wave points in. And it's not exactly...
Is that related to oxygen ordering or something like that?
No, because it's there both in the strontium system and in excess oxygen.
But these are orthorhombic samples.
These are orthorhombic, right, okay. Okay, let me just show you, because I'm sure I must be almost finished. That was stage four material, where the oxygens are every fourth layer apart, and the doping is very close to optimal doping. And then very recently, Young Li's gone back and looked at a very clean and beautiful stage six sample we had made. So this is the oxygens every sixth layer. So this is sort of, again, I think relatively clean. And in this case, 2 minutes, good, perfect, okay. And our first attempt to see spin density wave order in this sample failed. And it's probably because I was there during the experiments, and then I left. Young Li did it, and he's a phenomenally skilled experimentalist. He and Su Heng Li, so the Li team, did it. And okay, after some really considerable effort, they actually managed to pull out magnetic ordering spin density wave peaks in stage six. They're again around an eighth. They're again rotated similarly. By the way, just as an aside, there's a technique called neutron depolarization to prove that you have a, which is a way of demonstrating, I won't explain the technique, that you have a bulk superconductor. And this signal corresponds to the onset of bulk superconductivity. Okay. And these are a summary of Young Li's results. And stage four I already showed you. And the upper shows stage 6, and that's TC. And Young happened to draw on this line. With my own prejudice, I would have drawn the line coming to 0 here. And the error bars obviously allow you to do whatever you want. But basically, to within the errors once more in the stage 6 sample, which has a hole concentration which is around 0.1, the magnetic transition to the long-range magnetic order and superconducting transition coincide. And this TC has also increased slightly relative to the lanthanum strontium system at the same hole doping. So again, largely eliminating disorder has enhanced TC, and it's allowed a simultaneous transition to magnetic long-range order. No. Young Lee is passionate about this, and he would give you a series of arguments that this is coming from uniformly from all the layers, but because of the neutron diffraction itself, because the neutron diffraction signal depends, as you saw, the width changing drastically with doping, so the neutron scattering signal itself varies drastically with doping, and therefore you should be sensitive to any inhomogeneities in the charge density per layer, and there's no evidence for that. So the evidence, because the signal is so strong, is I think, quite convincing that it's a uniform charge density per layer and that this is a homogeneous phenomenon. And there at least is no evidence for microscopic heterogeneity in any of the neutron diffraction. Okay. In fairness, I should say that when you do mu SR on this system, you don't get the full signal. On the other hand, in the oxygen doped system, on the other hand, I actually discussed this with a muon expert in Europe. Before I told him what happened in the experiment, he said you shouldn't use muon for excess oxygen experiments because the muon instantly goes to the intercalated oxygen. So interpreting USR experiments in these systems is I think, difficult. Okay, so this is where we are. There are obviously, there are three messages, I think. One is that incommensurate spin fluctuations cover the entire region from 2% up to the end of the overdope region. And so if stripes matter, they matter everywhere, okay, not just in the underdope region, which has been what I've heard so far at this conference. The second thing is that in the lanthanum strontium system, that the insulator to superconductor transition coincides with and presumably is driven by a transition from diagonal to collinear stripes. The collinear stripes are not exactly collinear. It's a peculiarity, but actually are rotated off by a few degrees. And then the third is that in our best samples, which we would argue are the least disordered samples that anyone has looked at to date, because the origin of the charges is annealed, not quenched. These are the only systems for which that's true, that you get an enhancement of TC, and you get long-range magnetic order coinciding with the superconducting order. And that seems to be a pretty clean result from my point of view. Thanks. The moment is, the long-range ordered moment is 0.15 plus or minus 0.05 Bohr magnetons. Okay? So it's between 0.1 and 2.2 Bohr magnetons. And you can call that either large or something. I don't know if I want to go into a whole discussion. We consider that to be a significant moment. If you measure with mu SR, you get a much larger moment. You get an almost saturated moment locally. Almost a saturated moment locally. But that's locally, not the long-range order.
Has mu SR been done on these?
Yes. Yeah. Right. And the mu SR order parameter coincides with the neutron order parameter, except there's a peculiarity, which is that the temperature dependence is in the wrong half of the signal. And so the mu SR is not understood at the present time. Okay. So that's number one. Number two, where does the moment point? The only sample where we know the direction the moment points is in the stage 4. And there the moment points in the same direction along the Jyotashinsky-Maria direction, in the same direction as the bulk. And Young Lee determined that by looking at a lot of peaks. No, I didn't bring it. Okay, but it's in the paper. Okay, so we published the paper a year ago or so. So the moment points in the A direction, which is the Gyaloshinsky-Maria direction, and the phasing between the layers is that in the insulator. So at least the magnetic structure is consistent with having three spin-wide insulating magnets, because you have right, which run forever in one direction, and something, and then an antiphase domain wall, and then three spin-wide, right, with the insulating magnetic structure in between. Okay.
You mentioned that the incompatibility and TC forms a linear relationship all the way up to TC. Why is that for stage 4 and stage 6 samples? The TC are quite different, whereas the incompatibility are both a lot of 1/8.
The stage 4 is slightly less than 1/8. Approximately, but this is much more detailed now, and I haven't had a chance to think it through because that's the average of the two directions, and now we have more detail in the stage 4 in terms of the orthorhombicity. Yeah. All right, TC is 34, so in the optimal doped strontium is 37, right? So it's not very far away from the peak anyway.
Thought about the constancy of the effect of the rotates. You look at standard models of competing interactions. Competing interactions pick a particular weighting number. The terms, however, they pick which lattice direction the corresponding structures line up on are higher order derivative terms. You can't have a grad squared type term, but the lowest order term you can have is fourth order in derivatives. And so if that's the term that's determining the orientation of the stripes, it should have a rather small effect on the order of wavelength.
Yeah, but are you now going to tell me why that small term drives the insulator to superconductor transition?
No.
Okay, since that coincides. One thing I should say that makes me nervous here, by the way, so that, and I hope it's not the 13th stroke of the clock, that is that we have not succeeded in seeing the charge ordering peaks in any of these samples, and Takashi Imai has indirectly through NMR, and he'll tell us about it. And, you know, okay, so a student's doing it, and you say maybe the student's not doing, it's doing something wrong, but then she went back and looked at John Tranquata's neodymium dose samples and sees the charge ordering peaks cleanly there with the right signal to background. So we know, right, that the experiments were being done properly. So in these samples, which show this really robust long-range magnetic order, right, the charge ordering peaks are very difficult to see. Doesn't mean it's not there, but, I mean, you know, full honesty, I have to say, there is, you know, you might have expected charge ordering to have been better defined here. I, you know, intuitively would have based the arguments I gave you, and we have not succeeded in seeing those peaks yet.
I'm confused about the big sample. You said the signal is very small.
The moment's smaller.
Very small.
Well, we don't have a quantitative value yet, but it'll be more like 0.075 or 0.1.
So 10% of the intensity is like 0.1%.
Yeah, I don't want to give a number. Yeah. Okay.
Can I draw you the stage 4 line on your stage 6
No, not quite, but it's not that far off. It's not that far off. Okay.
Okay, I have time for one more question.
No, we looked around. We surveyed, but of course, if it's a very weak peak, right. Actually, I want to make one final statement. The other words that have been going around is that there's no resonant peak in the lanthanum copper oxide system. And it is true that none of us have yet succeeded in seeing a peak at the pi-pi position. However, two or three years ago, Tom Mason and Gabe Apley wrote a very nice paper, but they called it something different called the coherence effect, in which they showed that there was peak sharpening, which occurs at the incommensurate position just around the gap energy. And we've gone back and looked at that more carefully with Bernhardt-Keimer, and it's actually not peak sharpening. What happens is it's a two-component response, and a new peak appears at the superconducting transition temperature, which is resolution limited, which is therefore like the resonant peak and grows like as you go down in temperature. And so this, you know, more work has to be done in this, but it's, you know, one shouldn't make statements that there's not a resonant peak in the lanthanum copper oxide system. It may have a different character, but there is additional scattering, first to give them credit, discovered by Tom Mason and Gabe Apening. We were very skeptical. At the incommensurate wave vector. Yeah. I want to show it to you. No. No, it's Young Lee's data, and it's not processed. But it's real. It's at the incommensurate position. Correct. You used the word resonant. There is additional scattering which has many of the same characteristics of the resonant scattering, but at the incommensurate position. Okay. Wow, that's not a trivial statement. Okay. Right.
I'm not at the University of Tokyo. My primary appointment is at Central Research Institute of Electric Power Industry, and my adjunct appointment is at Science University of Tokyo, where Kamimura is. Okay. Anyway. Yep. Okay. So today I'm going to talk about the light redox region of the high-density cuprates, mostly lanthanum 214 and YBCO. And today I'm going to talk about three topics. One is the resistivity and isotropy of the diagonal slice, which you just heard from Bob. And also I'm going to talk about magnetic resistance anomaly and the kind of universal mobility of holes in these regions. So let me start with the this famous Yamada plot. So, in the superconducting region, we all know that the stripes make four peaks, and that is collinear stripes. And it is found recently that in the insulating region, below 0.05, the peak just becomes two. And this two peak indicates that the stripes lined along only one direction, which is the orthorhombic A-axis, like that. So it is natural from a transport experimentalist to see to the resistivity and isotropy caused by this unidirectional stripe. And that is what we did in the 0.04 concentration of LSCO. This is still a preliminary data, and we have done a measurement from 0.02 to 0.04, and the data is essentially reproducible. So what we found is that at high temperature, we didn't observe not much anisotropy. But as we lower the temperature, the anisotropy shows up. And the resistivity is actually smaller along the direction parallel to the stripe. And the resistivity is larger for the direction perpendicular to the stripe. Yeah. But this very rather small anisotropy worried us a little bit, because this doesn't suggest a rigid 1D system, which we expect for a system like the 1D organics, right? So there are, I think, two possibilities. One is the something like electronic liquid crystal, the nematic state is realized, or the transport is essentially bulk with some spin density wave-like scattering. So to elaborate more on these possibilities, so one possibility is that the diagonal stripes are just mainly spin density wave, and charges are only weakly confined. In this case, the effect we observed in the resistivity and isotropy is essentially a scattering effect with weak confinement. But the more interesting possibility is that the well-defined stripes exist, but they are highly disordered. Therefore, they can form system like this or like this. In any case, it can be electronic liquid crystal. And in this case, the effect we observed is essentially a topological effect with strong confinement. And of course, there are third possibility, which is not interesting. That is, the anisotropy is just due to orthorhombicity. But we can easily argue against this, because the orthorhombicity of the crystalline lattice is only less than 1%, and this should be temperature independent. However, we observe strong temperature dependence, right? The anisotropy grows from, say, below 150K down to, say, about around 30K. And actually, at this temperature, around 30K, the diagonal stripes becomes frozen. And we lose transport in all the directions, so the system becomes three-dimensional insulator, and that's the reason why we observe decrease in the resistivity anisotropy. Okay, and the next topic is the resistivity in a wider region. So this is a plot of the resistivity versus temperature. The resistivity is plotted in the logarithmic scale from the carrier concentration of just 1% up to 17%. Here you see that the resistivity is actually changing by orders of magnitude. But one thing we note is that this 1% doping shows a narrow, well-defined narrow transition at around 230K. But the resistivity stays surprisingly metallic, and we observe no anomaly around this temperature, which is one thing to note. And also the localization sets in rather at low temperature, in this case around 130K. And what is more interesting is that when we make a plot of carrier concentration times resistivity versus temperature, some interesting things show up. So this parameter is essentially an inverse of mobility, which bears the information of M star over tau. So this, and if we look at this plot, the magnitude of this inverse mobility is not much changing from the optimum doped LSC of 17% up to just 1% doped nail ordered LSCO. And this is happening in the region where the magnetic correlation length is very much rapidly changing. This is the Keimer's data for the magnetic correlation length. So at 1%, since we observe nail order at 330K, at the temperature of 200K, this is already diverging, right? And for at 0.03, the correlation length is only already below 100 angstroms, and at the optimum doping, this is like 30 angstrom or something. So although the magnetic correlation length is rapidly changing, we didn't observe a large change in the inverse mobility of the doped holes. So based on this data, we can draw a phase diagram like this. So there's a surprisingly wide region of the metal-like transport, which even cuts into the nail order state. And this is more actually evident in the YBCO data. Here, we plotted the data, the similarly normalized resistivity versus temperature from oxygen of 6.3, which has a nail transition temperature of 230, up to optimum doping of 6.91. And here, the change in the inverse mobility is less than a factor of 2 at high temperature, around at room temperature. So these data, to me, it's quite interesting, and we can make this a discussion based on this data. So the data suggests that the mobility of the doped holes at moderate temperatures around 300K are essentially independent of X, or essentially independent of the magnetic correlation length. This seems to indicate that the charged subsystem is insensitive to the, or decoupled from the magnetic subsystem at the energy scale of around 20 millielectron volts. And this is possible when the stripes are formed, okay? And the other possibility of this essential independence of X is that the charge transport mechanism in the lightly doped region is essentially the same as that at optimum doping, right? Because we observe the similar tau over M star. And so I would like to say that it is fundamentally important to understand the charge transport in the lightly doped region to understand the high TC superconductivity, because the inverse mobility data suggests that the transport mechanism is essentially unchanged from the 1% doping up to 17% doping. Okay. And the other thing to note is that since the very notion of the mobility seems to be well defined, even at the 1% doping, indicates that the Drude-like picture seems to be applicable for the 1% doping. However, if you look at the magnitude of the resistivity, that suggests that the KFL value is only 0.1. This should be in the strongly localizing regime, right? So it is impossible in the ordinary metallic transport. So this apparently violates the motif legal condition for metallic condition. Therefore, we need to consider a really exotic situation to understand this data. And the other thing in this region, it magnetic resistance anomaly. So this is the resistivity versus temperature of the sample we measured. These are YBCO crystals with oxygen of 6.3. And this is the magnetic resistance data. Magnetic resistance versus magnetic field, starting from 245 K, which is above nail transition temperature, down to around 30 K. And as you see, we observed a very striking anomaly, which is that the resistivity initially decreases rather sharply, but saturates at around 5 Tesla. And this is the data for the magnetic field and current parallel to each other, and they are both in plane. And when we apply the field perpendicular to the current, but still maintain it in the plane, this magnetic resistance anomaly flips the sign. So initially the data shows an increase and then saturates at around the same field of 5 Tesla. And here the data is down to around 30 K, but when we further reduce the temperature, the data start to show a hysteretic behavior. So at 20 K, we already start to show some hysteresis, and at 10 K, the magnetic resistance becomes rather strongly hysteretic. So for the first sweep of the magnetic field, the data starts from here, but upon coming back to zero field, the resistivity never comes back to the original value. This cannot be explained by any scattering mechanism. So more exotic mechanism like some topological reordering or something must be involved in this kind of magnetic resistance anomaly. And this data has been rather difficult to be interpreted, and I can list at least three possibilities for the explanation of this data. One is a bulk transport with spin density wave, and the other is a bulk transport with domain boundary scattering. These are not so much interesting scenario to us. And the most interesting scenario to us is the transport is essentially quasi-one-dimensional through the stripes, and the stripes are somehow topologically reordered with the application of the magnetic field. And I don't have time to go into details of this, but the data of the YBCO only are not enough to sort out which of these possibilities are really the case. And but in particular, the problem in the data in YBCO is that the effect is only observed in the nail order state, and also the observation is in just one system YBCO, and therefore may not be generic. And also one can argue that the size of the magnetic resistance is rather small. In the case of YBCO, it's like 1%, so may not reflect the essential physics. So therefore, we try to extend the measurement into other systems and into other magnetic states to make rebuttals to these criticisms. And when we measured neodymium-doped LSCO with 20% doping, this is the famous stripe, static stripe material. We observed similar magnetic resistance, magnetic resistance anomalies in a very narrow temperature window where the stripes are about to freeze. So in a sense, when the stripes become slushy just before freezing, we observe similar resistivity and magnetic resistance anomaly as in the case of YBCO. So, and this observation is not in the nail order state. So the magnetic resistance anomaly is not only observed in the nail order state. And I should note that the similar data has been reported by the Ohm's group for this system.
Do you really mean 0.2%,
sir?
Or do you mean 0.8%?
What? Oh yeah, this is very small. So this measurement is really difficult. Yeah.
What's
Excuse me?
What is LTD transient temperature?
It's ordinary 75 K, I think. And also, so this neodymium doped LSCO data indicates that the magnetic resonance anomaly is not only observed in the nail state. And then we also measured another system, pure LSCO with 1% doping. And this system also gave us similar magnetic resistance anomaly, like this. So above a certain magnetic field, the magnetic resistance starts to saturate. Okay. And in this system, when we reduce the temperature, this data is only down to 160K. But if we further reduce the temperature down to 7K, the magnetic resistance really becomes big. In this case, it becomes as big as roughly 30%. So it's not a real, only a tiny effect, but it can actually change the resistivity by a significant fraction. And in this, in the case of LSCO at 1% doping, and I should note that this data is for the similar configuration where the magnetic field and currents are both parallel to the plane. And in this case, when we apply current magnetic field parallel to the C-axis direction, there's a very striking first-order phase transition, which produces a like factor of two change in the resistivity. And this is clearly related to the ferromagnetic transition of the weak canted moment of the coupled planes. I don't have time to go into details, but this is essentially a side view of the coupled plane. And this ferromagnetic transition has been reported by Vaginov's group back in 1988, right? But essentially, although the observation is related to this ferromagnetic transition of the canted moment, if you look at the 2D spin system, there's no fundamental change. It's just the ordering of the phase of the antiferromagnetism between planes. So to observe this large change in the in-plane transport, rho AV, is actually quite surprising. So to summarize this part of my talk, the resistivity anomaly of the diagonally striped state of LSCO is small. So this indicates that the either bulk transport with spin density wave as scatterers or quasi-1D transport with disorder stripes are realized. And we cannot yet sort out which is the real possibility. And regarding the magnetic resistance anomaly, this is also observed in LSCO and can be very large. And the irreversibility indicates some topological effect. That's what I would like to argue. And the doped carriers have almost universal mobility at moderate temperatures. And this indicates that the transport mechanism in the lightly doped cuprates is expected to be fundamentally related to the transport mechanism at optimal doping. Therefore, it's fundamental to the superconductivity. And using the remaining minutes, okay, thank you. I'd like to present some BISCO data, which is a 60 tesla field work which we do in collaboration with Greg Bobinger. Okay. So in the we again use the 60 tesla field to wipe out the superconductivity and to observe the low temperature normal set resistivity. So this is a series of data we took in the 60 tesla from overdoped sample down to underdoped sample. And we observed that the low temperature resistivity actually crosses over from metallic behavior to the insulating behavior, but the crossover takes place in the underdoped region. You see, this 0.39 is the optimum doping with TC of 38K, but this is a metallic. And this one sample, 0.66, this is clearly underdoped, but this sample still shows metallic behavior. And the clear upturn is observed in the region well in the underdoped state. So we can make a phase diagram like this for this case, where the metal insulator boundary, which is defined by the minimum in the resistivity versus temperature curve, cuts in like this and ends at the carrier concentration, which we estimate to be between 0.11 and 0.13, which is essentially 1/8 carrier concentration. And recently, we measured the C-axis transport in this series of samples. And the C-axis transport at low temperature is essentially insulating in all the samples down to Lansdowne 0.2. This is the most overdoped sample we measured. Therefore, the final phase diagram we obtained for VSCO 2201 is something like this. So the insulating region starts below 1S composition. And in the wide region from 1S to the non-superconducting region, this boundary is yet to be confirmed. But in this wide region, we observe metallic low AB coexisting with insulating low C. So this is highly non-same liquid-like. And probably in this case of bismuth 2201, the 3D-like metal state is only realized in the non-superconducting region. And this is to be contrasted by the phase diagram we obtained for the LSCO. So this is the favorite phase diagram we keep showing for LSCO. So insulator to metal crossover occurs right at optimal doping. But if we reanalyze the raw data for this metal insulator crossover, we notice that some anomaly exists at 1S composition. This 0.12 data is 1S. And if you look at the resistivity, the minimum in the resistivity is around 100K. This is higher than the data for 0.08, which is more underdog sample. So if we take the minimum in the resistivity versus temperature curve as a boundary for the metal to insulator crossover, then we come up with a slightly different phase diagram for LSCO, which is this. So insulator, although the metal to insulator crossover occurs around optimal doping, there's an enhancement near 1S. So therefore, we can interpret this phase diagram as that this boundary may end at 0.12. However, there's a charge order instability occurring at 1S, which produces this dome. And because of the superposition of the dome onto the more intrinsic boundary, which might end at 1S, we observe the metal insulator crossover to occur at 1S. This is a possibility. Okay, that's it. Thank you for your attention. Okay, which data? BISCO, the raw data or the raw data. Yep.
This is happening, you're alleging deeply underdoped, not the underdoped side of the boundary. And yes, before you weren't here, we had a discussion about transport. Very often, at least in one case, the heat transfer, the heat conduction of the coefficients on the wall are incompatible with conventional metals. Now, that looks like ordinary metallic resistivity.
Now, which one?
Very well, but it's not insulating.
One is not insulating.
So is there any remote possibility you folks can measure heat transport?
Yeah, we measure the thermal transport, thermal conductivity in all these series of samples.
Just the way the Beeman-Franz law?
Well, it's difficult to say because of the phonon term. And the carrier doping dependence of the thermal conductivity at, say, 100K is not monotonically dependent on the carrier concentration. That has been puzzling us. And we have not yet able to sort out the reason. Therefore, we cannot publish the data yet.
May I have it?
Okay, yeah. Send me an email, please.
What?
No, this is above TC. Yeah. Oh, you need low temperature data? Well, measuring the thermal transport in 60 deciles is tough. Yeah. We need long time scale. Right. Yeah.
The magnetic, when you apply the magnetic field, are the data really the way you show them in the data in the field maps the data in zero field at the temperatures where the symbols hit the line?
Right. This is taken on the very same sample.
And the difference then is that something other than fluctuation conductivity for superconductivity or their magnetoresistance?
You mean this region?
Yes.
Yeah, this region is clearly some magnetoresistance. whose origin is not clear, but possibly a superconducting fluctuation, but also possibly due to normal state magnet resistance.
Because I noticed the one sample, the 1/8 sample.
Yeah. Oh, in that. Yeah, this
far
is big.
Far higher temperature than
anything. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So in this case, it is possible that the magnetic field is inducing some charge ordering or localization, but we are not sure. Yeah, actually, this magnet resistance is really big. Yeah.
Right, I've been promoted to theory. What makes that sound? What does that? Doing what?
I don't understand. I'd ask the question.
I'm going to take this off. Sorry. Well, okay. I'll try to live with that. I'm grateful for the chance to talk about some of the work we've been doing. I want first to acknowledge the people that did the work. Nick Curl, Byung-Jin Sa, were postdocs who took all of the data that you'll see today. Samples, very important, came from Ben Bushner and his collaborators, Alex Webb-Koleski and Ed Orsay. The topic, by the way, is glassy spin freezing. You'll see that stripes are not in that title. You will see a relationship as it goes along, but it's not perhaps the one you might expect. Really what I'm going to be talking about are low frequency spin dynamics and dramatic slowing of those spin dynamics, and the fact that these are extremely inhomogeneous. And in particular, I'm going to show that there's a relationship between these inhomogeneous slow spin dynamics and the copper wipeout that we've been hearing about. One of the main points that I hope you'll come away with is that this inhomogeneity is not simply a result of extrinsic disorder, but I will argue that it's more intrinsic and fundamental, at least in the lanthanum-cuprate system. So I'm not going to go through all of this, but because I think probably this audience knows pretty well what NMR can do, The main point I want to focus on is that I'll be showing you spin dynamics results. We'll be measuring the nuclear spin relaxation rate 1 over T1. Nuclear relaxation involves transitions between nuclear spin states, and as we know, that requires an alternating magnetic field at the resonant frequency. Therefore, this relaxation rate is a measure of the spectral density of electron spin fluctuations at that Larmor frequency. So this is what we're probing with dynamics. Another important point is it's proportional to the square of the magnitude of that local field. Now, we've known for some time that we have very slow spin fluctuations in the lanthanum cuprate system. This is very old and I think very important paper from the Ames Lab group, Fernando Borsa, David Johnston, in which I'm plotting here lanthanum relaxation rate as a function of temperature on a logarithmic scale. And you see this dramatic, dramatically strong peak in the relaxation rate at very low temperatures, 10 Kelvin, in systems where the nail temperature is up here around 100, between 100 and 200 Kelvin. This is a spin freezing peak, and I'll tell you more about that later. The second point that I'll emphasize more as I go along is that we then did a very similar experiment, except we changed dramatically the nature of the impurity that dopes the hole, namely we put it in plane. We see very similar behavior. Electron spin resonance measurements were then made in a system that's not in this low doping regime, but a much more heavily doped regime. Strontium 0.1, this is the analog of the neodymium material that we've heard about from John Pinquata, except europium is used because europium does not have a magnetic moment, so you remove this confusion that arises from having a large moment on the neodymium. Again, it's essentially the same measurement as I was using gadolinium as a probe. You measure 1 over T1, and this shows a dramatic slowing of spin fluctuations, again, a logarithmic scale. We've done similar measurements in this. I'm sorry. Now this is one of the arguments that was first made that I'm aware of that the ordering in these materials was glassy. This is from a paper by Nichumi et al. 98, in which they compared the onset of the spin ordering, which is observed in neutron scattering. So this is John Franquata's data, and they compared this to. I'm sorry, this is John Franquata's data, this is MuSR data, and they compared the two. And the point is that the spin ordering temperature that was seen in neutrons was very different from the spin ordering temperature that was seen from MuSR. And the idea is that the muons is a slower probe, and therefore, if you have a continuous slowing of the characteristic spin fluctuation frequency, the temperature at which that fluctuation becomes static will depend on the frequency of your probe. So picoseconds versus nanoseconds or tens of nanoseconds gives you this change in ordering temperature. And so they argued that this was evidence for glassy behavior. So we've done some very careful studies of the lanthanum nuclear spin lattice relaxation rate in these rare earth co-doped crystals. Now these are materials in which the presence of the rare earth causes this well known, I think, low temperature orthorhombic to low temperature tetragonal transition. And that's evident in the T1 is a very strong decrease in the relaxation rate, again, a logarithmic scale. These are single crystals. This structural transition is argued to stabilize the stripe structure and make it visible on a static or a quasi-static time scale. I'm going to be focusing again on this very strong spin freezing peak. Again, there's a dramatic distinction between the ordering temperature seen in neutrons and that seen with muons. I'll point out that there's the nail transition has no effect on the relaxation rate. And certainly, it's nothing compared to this strong spin freezing peak. So first, I want to spend just a little bit of time to try and understand that spin freezing peak. So I've replotted that here as a function of 1 over temperature on a logarithmic scale, same thing, lanthanum relaxation rate. And the reason for this particular method of plotting is that it brings out an activated temperature dependence, which characterizes the slowing of these spin fluctuations. So this is the very sharp peak at low temperature that you saw earlier on the plot, and this is the high temperature data that had to do with the structural phase transition, so I will not be talking about that. I want to focus on this low temperature peak. The second thing you'll note is that on the high temperature side, this is at 1 over T, on the high temperature side, the data are independent of the resonant frequency, independent of the Larmor frequency, whereas when we go through this peak, this becomes frequency dependent. And the reason I emphasize this is a very classic sign of this continuous slowing of the spin fluctuation peaks, and in fact, it's a mechanism that was first posed to us by Blomberg and Pound and Purcell many years ago, near the discovery of nuclear magnetic resonance. And let me try and tell you why this peak occurs, and then why we get this particular characteristic frequency dependence. As I mentioned earlier, the relaxation rate is a probe of the spectral density of spin fluctuations measured at the Larmor frequency. And typically one observes a Lorentzian dependence of this spectral density on frequency. Because of the local moment sum rule, the area under this peak, so if you integrate this over all omega, this area has to be conserved. So now as you change this characteristic spin fluctuation frequency, 1 over tau c, that corresponds to moving the knee of this spectral density function. But as you bring the knee in, the value at very low frequency has to increase in order to conserve it, the area under this curve. So what you'll see is that as you reduce this knee, the intensity at low frequency increases. So if we're sitting at some Larmor frequency, as we reduce tau c, we'll see an increase in the relaxation rate because we're seeing an increase in j. So that's this behavior right here. And what was observed in a variety of liquids, which is the experiments that motivated this measurement, is the same thing that we see, namely that this characteristic fluctuation time exhibits an activated temperature dependence. So what happens is this knee is moving down with decreasing temperature, increasing relaxation rate. But this doesn't go on forever. If you happen to get to the point where the characteristic fluctuation frequency passes through the Larmor frequency, you pass through this knee in the Lorentzian distribution function. Note this is logarithmic scales. You pass through this knee, and then you're on this 1 over omega squared tail of the distribution function, and the value of j of omega l starts to decrease again, and that's why you go through a peak. So there's two things that are important about this. The first is that means that this peak occurs when the Larmor frequency matches the characteristic spin fluctuation frequency. So that means that the electronic spin fluctuations in this system are of order 50 megahertz at 10 Kelvin. That's a very, very slow spin fluctuation frequency, and it's something I think that indicates very large regions of order. The second point is that this predicts a very specific frequency dependence, namely no frequency dependence on the high temperature side and a frequency dependence that comes in on the low temperature side, and this is precisely what we see. So I think that this is a pretty clear demonstration that this peak is due to continuous slowing of spin fluctuations. This is not a phase transition. This is just continuous slowing of spin fluctuations. Now, one difference between our result and the conventional result of BPP is that once you go through with the characteristic activation energy, you should see a very rapid drop of the relaxation rate. You lose these spin fluctuations very fast. What we find is that this relaxation rate continues to stay high to very low temperatures. And what that tells you is it's not a single well-defined activation energy, but we have to postulate a distribution of activation energies. So this is an intrinsically inhomogeneous process, which is responsible for this peak, but for the fact that we don't lose our spin fluctuations really rapidly at low temperatures. And I'll show you in a minute that the copper wipeout is a very explicit and direct demonstration of this inhomogeneity, very strong inhomogeneity. So this is the distribution of activation energies that we found would fit our data. And the interesting points about it are two. One is it's a characteristic activation energy of about 70 Kelvin, which is very close to the stripe formation temperatures that we get from neutron scattering.
but also that the distribution is very comparable to the center. So this is very inhomogeneous spin fluctuations. Yes? No, it doesn't. Well, people will argue with you. I claim, and I think Buchner claims, that the rare earth co-doped materials do not superconduct intrinsically. There's typically filamentary superconductivity, but I think it's not intrinsic. So it's an insulator.
So you got
it's an antiferromagnetic insulator.
Well,
I think I just heard in the previous talk that they were saying that their samples are at 4 Kelvin they see. John? I don't know. In this particular sample, I can't tell you where there's if there's a resistivity that goes to zero. I think there is around 4 Kelvin, but I don't know that. No, no, europium doesn't matter. This is just what it takes to make it LTT. It's 1/8 doped strontium. Yes, this phase diagram is well worked out by Buchner. Europium 0.2 is very similar to neodymium 0.6. It has to do with the size of the ion. This is very well worked out. There is dispute whether this is superconducting or not. I guess you were the one that said that there was superconductivity at 4 Kelvin. It's very similar. The issue there, and I'm not particularly ready to have that argument. My understanding is that Barrett believes that these do not superconduct. But I don't think that's a central issue. Although, I believe it's an antiferromagnetic insulator that you should think about in terms of spin fluctuations. Are you the one that does this? Okay. Maybe you have a little sapphire. Okay. So one of the things that we can do is go back and look at all of these different sets of data for lanthanum cuprate doped in various ways and analyze this in terms of now this theory that gives us an explanation of the relaxation peak in terms of an activation energy and a distribution. So these are the two sets of data I showed earlier. This is strontium doping. This is the data from the Ames lab group. Very lightly strontium doped of the conventional type. So we see an activation energy, again, about 60 Kelvin with a very broad width, very comparable to the center. Put in-plane doping, lithium instead of strontium. One would expect that this would have a dramatic effect on scattering in the plane, yet you get essentially the same parameters. Here we have two systems which are LTT. One is very highly doped, 1/8. One is very lightly doped, and again, very similar characteristics. So the main point of this slide is you can get a wide variety of materials, highly doped, lightly doped, different types of dopants, and you see very similar spin freezing characteristics. So the two conclusions that I would draw from this is that this spin freezing is a very common feature of lanthanum cuprates, and that it does not depend in detail on how you introduce, what sort of impurities you introduce, for instance, to produce doping. All right, the second thing that I would like to turn to now is to point out the relationship this has to the copper wipeout phenomenon that I think Takashi will talk about a little bit more. What I've done here now, everything I've talked about up to now is lanthanum relaxation rate, which I reproduce here in the lower panel. In the upper panel, I show the copper relaxation rate from the same sample. The red symbols are from the rare earth co-dope sample, and I've shown data from the same doping of strontium but without the rare earth. And the high temperature copper relaxation is essentially identical. In fact, it's identical all the way to low temperatures, except that the strontium material goes superconducting, and this comes in to some finite value, presumably because it's an insulator and not a superconductor. The question that obviously comes to mind when you look at these two sets of data is it doesn't look like they have anything to do with each other. And the question is why. If you look at this in detail, quantitatively, it soon becomes evident that you can expect a problem. This is an extremely rapid relaxation rate. This is for lanthanum, which lies out of the copper oxygen plane and has a hyperfine coupling of order a kilogauss per Bohr magneton.
Copper, on the other hand, has a very strong coupling to these spin fluctuations, two orders of magnitude larger. As I mentioned earlier, the relaxation rate goes like the square of that field. So one can expect that if this gives relaxation times of order milliseconds, that for copper we should expect of order nanoseconds. And this is much, much too fast to detect in an NMR experiment. So immediately you would say, well, there's no way we should even be able to see this signal. And in fact, that's what's happening, except for the fact that, as I pointed out, this is an inhomogeneous situation. Not all of the lanthanum sites see the same fluctuating field, nor do all the copper sites. So in fact, what happens is that one inhomogeneously loses copper signal. So what we can do is directly take the distribution of activation energies that we determined from the lanthanum relaxation rate measured in the same sample and use that to predict a distribution of tau c's. So here we plotted a distribution of tau c's. Now, as I was mentioning earlier, 1 over T1 is proportional, is simply proportional to tau in the high temperature side of this Lorentzian distribution of the peak in that relaxation rate. So very long taus lead to very fast T1s. It's relatively straightforward to predict what tau will be so large that you cannot measure it in your spectrometer, knowing the characteristics of your spectrometer. So what you can argue is that you will be able to see any copper spin for which tau is less than some cutoff value. So then predicting the intensity of the copper signal is simply a matter of integrating P of tau up to this cutoff. And when you do that, you get the blue line, which I've plotted along with our data for the copper intensity. Actually, the number of copper spins, that's intensity multiplied by temperature to account for the Curie law intensity of, rather, the Curie law polarization of the copper moment. So the point, one point here is that directly using the distribution of activation energies obtained from lanthanum relaxation, we directly predict the copper relaxation, I'm sorry, the copper wipeout phenomenon. And in particular, this phenomenon is entirely due to spin freezing phenomena. And in there's no need to invoke any words about stripes at this point. What matters is what you think is causing the spin freezing. The second point is that this is direct and completely interpretation-free evidence for inhomogeneous spin fluctuations, because at some temperature, say this temperature, half of the copper spins have very rapid spin fluctuations and half of them have slow copper electron spin fluctuations. So what we have here is regions of the sample with very fast spin fluctuations and regions with very small spin fluctuations. And this way, we can very directly understand the copper wipeout phenomena. It's worth pointing out that this is, in fact, not an unknown situation at all. And in particular, I showed some data here from the 1980s from the Illinois group in a conventional spin glass system in which they see this wipeout phenomenon. And it's my understanding that this was fairly commonly observed in these spin glass systems. Now, of course, Takashi will speak, I think, in a minute about this data. He's produced these phase diagrams, which I think are very obviously important and are telling us something very, very significant about the system. For me, the question is, what exactly is it that they're telling us? I think the point I would make is that this is a phase diagram for freezing of spin fluctuations. And in particular, there's some very recent data obtained with muon spin resonance from Panagopoulos et al. Published on the server, the LANL server, in which they have produced a phase diagram for spin freezing, this is TF, spin freezing, as a function of strontium concentration, which is obtained by looking for the temperature at which the muon depolarization rate, deviates from a simple single relaxation rate phenomenon, starts showing distributed relaxation rates, then they define T glass as the point at which it becomes stretched exponential with a power law of 1/2. But this is the freezing temperature, the point at which you begin to see a departure from conventional dynamics. And the point is that we see a very the same characteristic upturn in the phase diagram, which they attribute to freezing, and I think it's probably a very similar situation. Of course, this is being measured in a different way, so it won't be, and it is not in detail the same numbers, but the same systematics are there. So the point here is I think that the phase diagram from copper wipeout should be understood to mean spin freezing. How you interpret that in terms of stripes, my personal belief is that probably does have something to do with striped glassy behavior. And if that's true, then this phase diagram does indicate, at least in order to have striped glassiness, you have to have stripes. So I think it does have some relationship to stripes. But it's important to understand, I think, in detail what that wipeout is telling you. And this is just something I wanted to show, and there was a question earlier in the session about the gap. I think this is a very remarkable result. This is copper relaxation rate data. 1 over T1T is a function of temperature. This is the same system where I'm showing two different dopings, 1.8 and slightly higher doping. Those are the solid symbols. Again, for comparison, I show the same doping of the conventional strontium materials at high temperatures. They look extremely similar. And the striking result is that for 1.8, one sees a very strong gap, so-called spin gap, which we can characterize as having a temperature of order 70 Kelvin where the onset occurs. And at low temperatures, again, this increases because, again, this is an antiferromagnetic insulator, not a superconductor. If you go up to slightly higher doping, this phenomenon is completely absent. One sees a very typical behavior for the antiferromagnet. And I think this is very interesting that commensurate doping produces this very dramatic effect on the spin gap. And, well, I don't think I have time to go into this, but one could argue that it might have something to do with lattice pinning, which would alter striped glassy, striped dynamics, and therefore, if glassy dynamics were responsible, it might alter that, or it could have something to do with ladders. So let me put up my conclusion slide and conclude. Thank you.
I'm not sure. What was the take out wiped out? We were talking about the relaxation rate, 1 over T1.
I'm sorry.
And then you said we're missing copper signal. And I couldn't think fast enough to figure out.
Okay, actually, this is data I think a lot of people are familiar with, so I'll start with that. What's being plotted here is what Takashi calls F, F, which is simply 1 minus the number of copper spins which are observable in the spectrometer.
Is that a negative number?
You're saying it should be normalized.
That's normalized?
Yes. So this is the same, this is just N spins. And the point is that at high temperatures you see all the spins that you expect to see. You know how many copper spins are in your sample? You see all of them, but as you decrease, you don't see all of the sample. You don't see all the spins in the sample. Until at low temperatures you're seeing essentially none. By low temperature there's no signal. The point here is that a lot of us spent a lot of time trying to understand why signals we couldn't do NMR in these materials. Takashi very carefully tried to understand that and did the systematics and showed that it was a very general and interesting phenomenon. It's lots of signal.
People see similar freezing in
London, right? That's
why. I'm sure there's a result.
President, in Ben DeChimney's Neil's study of the indium doping, he saw a distribution of hyperfine fields at low temperature, which is reasonable if you have a modulated spin density in the system. I was just wondering, presumably the lanthanum should also, if it's seeing the same sort of behavior, it should see a distribution of hyperfine fields at least at low temperature. Could that contribute some to the inhomogeneity that you see? I mean, is it just fluctuations or would a distribution of hyperfine fields have similar effects?
That would be a pretty small effect. This is an exponential, this exponential dependence gives a very, it's very sensitive to this tau c. So that while that effect would be there, it would be small compared to this. It certainly wouldn't be enough to cause some sort of, to cause this sort of a wipeout phenomenon, for instance. I mean, those are matters of a few, well, maybe 10%, something at most.
Please, would you put back the slide with the
Okay.
Now, I'm always very concerned about how this mass transition of glassy behavior is connected. I mean, for example, no, there was one with my couples.
Oh.
See, if you look at the freezing here, which is obtained by looking at the deviation from the Gaussian.
Right.
And now, on the other hand, if you look at the Lattice function carbon dioxide, I'll talk at that. And it's clearly the boundaries are very different. And the point is that it's always very unclear how one defines this glassiness in the system. And then, isn't there thermodynamic, the spin glass should have a thermodynamic signature in susceptibility. And
What people, both of these are measuring continuous slowing of spin fluctuations, and they're intrinsically inhomogeneous. This technique is extremely sensitive to the leading edge of this. I want to stab somebody here. To the leading edge of this. This starts. You start to see loss of signal as soon as you enter this distribution of fluctuation of activation energy. The new SR, it's where it starts to bend down. So there's the issue of this frequency of your probe. In this case, there's the issue of the magnitude of the hyperfine coupling to that fluctuation. So these things can all lead to.
Suppose I want to determine what the speed loss transition actually is, and you have that speed loss transition.
Well, in principle, I guess you have to go to zero frequency.
Have you updated measurements of that kind?
Not that I know of in a general sense. Fangcheng Chu did a fairly careful measure in the spin glass regime using magnetization, which is fairly low frequency. That actually, I'm not sure it's the same thing, because that really was attributable to a small number of spins, whereas this is more or less involving all the copper, all the electronic moments. So I'm not even sure if that's the same thing. But that's the only low frequency measurement that I know of where there was at least a certain span of dopings that was examined.
I have a question.
At low doping.
This classic experiment shows that there's tons of magnets in lanthanum in this particular material, all the way up to 1.17 doping degrees.
Yes.
Maybe more. Okay. Now, but this is the schmutziness of the kuprates. So is it true for all of them? Is it true for good ones like this, though? Or is it just this lousy lanthanum something like that?
Takashi is going to show us something from YBCO, which I think is most of us know and love as being not schmutzy. My feeling is
high quality samples.
My belief is that this is a fairly general phenomenon, but it's not so evident in this strong way that I know of. Except, I'm anxious to see what Takashi is going to show.
So this is a magnetic transition, and you can see, and the two very different types of probes agree quantitatively with each other. So
So it springs into life fully with the full moment. That's really unusual.
Can you hear me in the back? Can you hear me? Now, before talking about new stuff, this is now the infamous paper on electron dot sample, which somehow disappeared in history. Now, I'd like to thank the organizers to give me opportunity to talk about our new experiments. I want to make 3 points. Number one, we have recently developed helium-3 wide frequency range spectrometer, and we carried out NMR experiments down to 350 millikelvin, but we still don't see any evidence for really clean, static, periodic modulation of spin and charge. And what we want to say is, at NMR timescale, it's still extremely disordered, even at 350 millikelvin. The point number two is, Wipeout shows the onset of the slowing of stripes, and that behavior in clean 2-1-4 compounds continues only after about 0.13. And then last year, at the end of my talk, this gentleman here, Doug Scarpino, pressed me to say if it's the signature of competition between superconductivity or stripe, and I refuse to say anything about that. Now, there's experiment here. So we suppress superconductivity by zinc doping, and then turned out that this anomaly continues up to about 18 or 19%, but above 20% we don't see. Point number three, we worked on calcium doped 1-2-3 compound. In underdoped regime, we observe basically the same kind of behavior, anomalous slowing, glossy slowing of spin dynamics. But if we load the sample with oxygen, increase the hole concentration, that anomaly disappears and shows crossover to spin gap, I mean, pseudo gap like behavior. Now, this is the first part of my talk, Zeeman part of the NQR. So we observe copper nuclear quadrupole resonance, and copper nuclear quadrupole moment interacts with charge. So to be specific, you sum up Coulomb potential from everything, all charge and holes, and take second derivative. That's what we see as this nuclear energy level splitting for copper, and then we see one resonance transition for one unique site. But if you have frozen spins that produce static hyperfine feed, then this energy level is perturbed, and we expect to see splitting of lines. So if you have well-defined periodic modulation of stripes, you expect some several sites, depending on the position in the stripe phase, then you may observe a bunch of different lines. So that's what we wanted to see. That's what we set out to look for 2 years ago. But what happened was, all that happens is with decreasing temperature, below charge ordering temperature. Actually, I'm showing only barium sample here. The europium dope sample and also neodymium dope sample show identical behavior. So with decreasing temperature, nothing happens down to charge ordering temperature over here. But below that, even though charge order is reported by scaling measurement, we still don't see any anomaly in the line shape. The only thing we see is just intensity begins to drop below charge ordering temperature. And intensity drops and drops and drops. And by 10K, signal is essentially gone. And this missing signal is what we call wipeout fraction. Now, if you keep cooling the sample below 8K, eventually signal intensity comes back, but the line is awfully broad, tens of times broader. And at 1.7K, we knew that signal was not fully recovered about a year ago, so we invested 1 year and $50,000 and developed Helium-3 cryostat in hopes that if you fully cool and freeze, then eventually you may see structures. But we didn't see anything, basically the same shape. Intensity recovers. I don't have time to go into the details, but this arrow indicates the full intensity in this kind of hyperfine Bloden regime. So we now have essentially full intensity, but we don't see any structures here. Now, in this experiment of the same kind of samples, it's been known for almost 10 years that for the time duration of about 1 microsecond or less, you can see clear beat. And this beat frequency corresponds to certain magnitude of hyperfine, magnetic moment, and that's estimated to be about 0.3 mu beat. So what Mirza group is saying is that for the time duration about 0.7 microsecond, there's well-defined 0.3 Bohr magneton, and also by scattering measurement, if you go with faster time scale, spin-spin correlation length is as long as 200 angstroms. So if you believe this NuSR result, and then utilize that energy level diagram, then you can calculate based on various stripe model, like this is original proposal by John, site-centered, bone-centered, incommensurate, and so forth. Then you can calculate corresponding hyperfine field distribution and then simulate the line shape. While this is experimental result, the peak is shown by this red line. And we can't see any of these sharply defined signatures expected for cleanly defined frozen stripe. That's absent. On the other hand, it took a long time for us to figure out, but Allen Hunt made a very important observation. We just show this has nothing to do with stripe, just we distributed hyperfine field up to like 4 Tesla. And since we know hyperfine coupling, this corresponds to like a maximum of 0.3 mu b of frozen moment. Then you calculate the line shape shown in B here, and it agrees well. Although in commensurate spin density wave of 0.3 mu b, what you should really expect is this kind of clear peak over here, although in this case, it's going to zero. Even if you just disorder this spin density wave field distribution, you still cannot reproduce experimental result. However, let's abandon 0.3 mu b. Let's say spins are still fluctuating very slowly, as Chris also emphasized. Suppose it's very slowly moving, and it's averaged over NMR timescale of about 20 microseconds. Remember, MuSR people observe spins static for 0.7 microseconds, but we need 20 microseconds to see. So suppose it's still motionally averaging. Then imagine spin happens to be about 0.2 mu b instead of 0.3, but it's broadened. Then we can have reasonable line shape. So what this shows is, in order to reconcile our NMR experiment on MuSR, if you believe in MuSR result, we need to have very slow dynamics, even at 350 millikelvin. Now, what's about intensity? Now, there are a couple of funny stories about our PRL paper Chris introduced. The first funny story is, if you look at the condensed matter archives, the preprint of our paper, Chris renamed it T-freeze, but actually we called it in the beginning TNQR. We didn't want to call it T-charge, but the referee didn't like it. Referee insisted that we had too many parameters, so we had to reduce it. So we ended up calling it T-charge because for neodymium doped compound, it's identical. The second funny story is, although we pretended that we discovered the wipeout effect at MIT in 1998, I think, but actually that's not the first discovery. The only reason we pretended it was the first discovery was otherwise you can't make it to PRL, as you know, right? The first discovery actually was made in my thesis work in 1990. So I think it's legal to pretend, you know, ignore the old paper. So what I pointed out in my old paper is Whenever resistivity blows up in high-tension cuprate, somehow NMI intensity decreases without showing any anomalous behavior in kappa relaxation rate. And also we found that, but at that time we didn't do so-called T2 correction. That's very important to measure intensity properly. So we didn't realize that things are happening very sharply. And also my friend Yoshimura and company realized that in this temperature regime, Ransom vulnerable T1 is blowing up. And after all, in the base temperature, this kind of sample always shows spin glass freezing. So we thought it's entirely random spin glass precursor, and we didn't even pay attention to it. We just thought it's boring old physics. What's really new in Alan Hunt's work, my student work, is we have to do so-called T2 correction to measure intensity. Then it turned out that intensity drops really sharply, and this sharpness is most striking exactly at 1H. In other words, other concentrations it's smeared, but it's sharply defined onset of that only around 1H. And also, even more striking thing is if you invert this intensity loss and compare it with neutron charge over a parameter, it shows identical temperature dependence. It's not just for 1H phase. If you increase whole concentration to like 15%, we find again very sharply defined onset to wipeout, and it turned out that this onset temperature agrees very well with diffraction measurement carried out by, is that Niemöller or Zimmermann? Charge order parameter onset is right around here. Now, so above 12%, we never see tailed onset to wipeout, but below 12%, it's always tailed. So onset itself is higher, but it turned out that there's this kind of inflection point. Namely, for instance, if you look at 9%, wipeout is gradual, so things are gradually slowing, but then there's an inflection point. It's not so clear, but 7% you can see more clearly. And subsequent diffraction experiment shows that this inflection point corresponds to the charge order temperature by scattering. So there's clear correlation with onset above 12% and also reach inflection point above 12%. So there is something to do with charge order. In addition, as Chris explained very carefully, T1, first T1 and T2 are the keys to account for, at least semi-quantitatively, the intensity loss of kappa. But by the same token, Ransom signal also loses signal, but that takes place at lower temperature. And also another interesting thing is whenever we see this kind of intensity loss below the same temperature range, we observe enhancement of vulnerable T1T. So what I want to emphasize is enhancement of spin fluctuations observed in vulnerable T1T takes place essentially at the same temperature as the onset to wipeout. So they are correlated. And remember, the onset to wipeout correlates with charge order. So what's happening about wipeout? I guess I don't have to spend too much time on this. So in our PRA paper, we propose two potential contributions. Number one, after all, charge is known to freeze. I mean, charge is known to order below charge ordering temperature. And if charge fluctuates, that should cause extreme line bowling. And also, although we didn't mention, that can, in principle, enhance quadruple relaxation rate. But at the same time, although many people overlook this statement, we said that if charge stripe develops below the temperature, spin fluctuations begin to slow down. If you look at our paper, it's stated clearly, repeatedly in different publications. So if spin fluctuations slow down, then we said 1 over T1, 1 over T2 should diverge. And if you have diverging T1, T2, you can't see the signal. What Chris achieved is account for this second process we proposed that basically put it into numbers. So I don't really see fundamental difference, at least phenomenological level, what we are saying. If there is some fundamental difference between them and us, he doesn't want to say anything about charge. But on the other hand, we do believe that there is clear correlation with charge order, as I explained before. And also, Chris wants to say everything is continuous, but what we believe, and actually I still believe, is remember that relaxation rate is inversely proportional to the energy scale of spin fluctuations. And imagine charge overlaying or slowing of charge dynamics reduces the energy scale of spin. Then 1 over TI immediately blows up. So we don't really have to say everything is continuous. That's what we originally conjectured in our paper. Having said, it's still interesting to play with numbers, so we extended the analysis of Chris invented. But in reality, Kappa Energy signal increases back, and Ransom decreases and goes back. So instead of having one characteristic frequency to account for intensity, we have to introduce three more characteristic frequencies to fully account for everything. And this is a fit. We can fit, at least at the phenomenological level, everything together with mu SL data and neutron scattering data. And what we are doing here is assume certain dynamic range of spin fluctuations. So at higher temperatures, neutron people already showed that there is so-called omega over T scaling. So there is well-defined single energy scale in spin fluctuations. Then below charge overlaying, imagine that dynamic range begins to broaden. So this bar corresponds to omega over T part. That fraction corresponds to still observable NQL signal. But unobservable NQL signal corresponds to this kind of slowing down part. So as long as frequency, top spin fluctuation frequency is slower than this level, that part is gone. But if spin fluctuation slows down enough to this frequency in this model, then signal begins to come back. So by using these constraints, you can calculate the dynamic range of the function temperature. And I replot this over here. So above 65K, you have only omega over T bar, which is not shown. But below 65K, spins begin to slow down. Now, actually, this is only a half of the story. If you look at this, although this kind of model account for, so this is basically a BPP model Chris was using, we can reproduce this kind of signal recovery. But remember that in this particular model, we have to say spin fluctuation frequency is like a kilohertz or slower. It's essentially static. I mean, it's entirely static. That's what this model says in Lorentzian-like dynamics. But remember the first part of my talk. I said, well, if we trust mu SL and NMR both, we still need to have fluctuations. So this Lorentzian model actually contradicts with our first part of my the experiment, namely, we need the slow dynamics. How do we reconcile this? The answer is, if you abandon Lorentzian dynamics and imagine there's crossover to different kind of dynamics, say Gaussian, then instead of slowing down forever, it turns out that frequency has to level around here. And this is comparable to NMR frequency. So as long as there's crossover in spin dynamics to some different mode, say Gaussian, then slowing of spin dynamics is labeled around here, like 10 to 7 parts. Then that accounts for everything. Then in order to say that, basically we need to have something to limit the slowing of fluctuation, and it's very tempting to say it has something to do with slow motion charge, but that's speculation. So to summarize about wipeout and so forth for neodymium and europium dope sample, so onset of wipeout, as John showed, is going like this, monotonically decreasing with whole concentration, and cross is a transport anomaly, and this is the inflection point in wipeout, and these are the charge order onset measured by diffraction measurement. And what I'm showing by darker and darker color is different sets of measurement, neutron, wipeout, USR, and signal recovery, and so forth. And darkest part corresponds to the slowest part of spin fluctuations in straight. Namely, 1S is the most stable phase, that's why it's darkest. However, remember, this probably is not static yet. Now, if this happens only for neodymium and europium doped sample, after all, superconductivity is suppressed, so it's not interesting. But the same thing happens without neodymium and europium doping. So these blues show the onset to wipe out, but above about 13%, we don't see it. Once superconductivity becomes robust, we can see it. However, and also one more point, below about 5% where Bob and company observed diurnal stripe, all of a sudden wipeout temperature jumps to comparable to nail temperature. In addition, there are some other different signatures in NMR I don't have time to discuss. So something is going on at the boundary between diurnal and vertical, and also this kind of behavior we observed for neodymium dope sample is still observable. Now, so we doped zinc and suppress superconductivity. They found out that this anomaly doesn't really change much below 12%. But once superconductivity is suppressed, you still observe the same kind of anomaly, but above 20%, it's gone. We don't see it anymore. Well, to be precise, something is going on below about 2K, but I think it's basically random conventional sense of spin glass physics induced by local moment surrounding zinc. So that's 214, and I know that a lot of people don't like 214, so we have to say something about 123, right, Bob? So we went to calcium doped 123. The advantage of calcium doped 123 is you can precisely control hole concentration if you reduce the sample. So calcium 14% corresponds to 7% doping. And let's see, this one, one of the T1 is for crystal, 15% doping, but oxygen is about 0.8. Actually, crystal was grown by my German collaborator. Now, interesting thing, first of all, is for the same hole concentration, one of the T1, 123 shows basically the same behavior as 214. But if you increase hole concentration, you eventually regain typical 123 sable-like behavior. But notice that measurement stopped somehow, like for instance, like 7.5% strontium sample, measurement stopped at 100K in 1993. That was because of wipeout, signal disappeared. The same thing happens for calcium doped 123. And in the same temperature region, we found that yttrium NMR shows line broadening, and also one about TMT blows up and shows maximum clear signature of freezing of spin at NMR timescale. By the way, geo samples, one about T1T and also night shift, show very similar behavior to 123 around 6.4 without calcium doping. So this is essentially the last data I want to show. If I summarize, in the top panel, male temperature in calcium doped 123 was measured by a French group in 1993, so this is a boundary. But we found that there's spin freezing measured by yttrium 1 over T1T divergence, and also the same result was obtained by Niedermeyer et al. By Mirsal. But in addition, we found basically the same kind of signature wipeout, broadening of NMR line, and enhancement of 1 over T1T for yttrium instead of lanthanum, starting from very high temperature. Actually, this onset is about a factor 2 higher than in 214. Now, you can say, certainly, well, you doped calcium, so again, you created a mess. It's just dark, right? That's what you want to say. After all, the bottom panel is my old thesis work at Tokyo, presented at the IBM Mount Fuji Conference in 1989. One of the T1T of like 1.37 and 6.5 show this kind of behavior, and we don't see it in calcium underdoped region. So look at this block. Calcium 0.22, so 11% doping. We don't see any signature or pseudogap or anything. So you can say, okay, wipeout started around here, but it's because of that effect by calcium doping. However, if you load the sample with oxygen, increase hole concentration, then we see it doesn't quite decrease down to TC for one of the T1T, but basically this kind of saturation is similar to the pseudogap behavior observed previously for radial 123. And also for the crystal, even though 15% is doped, one of the T1T is essentially identical with regular 1.237. So it's not just that effect. So here is a summary about calcium dope 1.23. Thank you for your attention.
Is there any agreement among you magnetism people about where the damn order is? This is getting awfully frustrating for us to hear the constantly conflicting.
Can I ask you a question? Can I ask you a question? What do you mean by order?
What? Order means you see red spots. That's what I mean by order.
I'm being ordered along.
Sure.
I think he addressed my question.
There are subtle ordering issues in these materials, and we've known for a long time it's material dependent.
No, my point is it's not so material dependent after all. 1, 2, 3 shows very similar behavior to 2, 1, 4. That's my point.
Well, how do I know your hand works?
You don't have to know.
Why is it my responsibility to check the quality of your sample? I don't understand that.
Well,
there's no inconsistency. The USR shows the same result.
Oh, sure, that's right. So for the sample, we observe each one of the T1 tissues cast basically at the same temperature. Actually, I think I have a transparency of Niedermayer's data. I didn't show it. So the bottom panel shows Niedermayer's newest result. Basically the same temperature. So at the similar time scale, what they see is spin freezing takes place at the same temperature in our samples. But what I'm saying is that starts at much higher temperature in 1, 2, 3.
This is a question. What happens if you don't go for the calcium and just use oxygen?
Thank you very much for asking that question. History is the following. In 1991, the first project of myself at Illinois was to look for NMR signal with decreasing Hall concentration towards zero. The first case I tried was 1, 2, 3. Never published anything. The reason? Around 6.3 and 6.4, there was a wipeout. There was no signal. So I didn't pursue. But for 2, 1, 4, I was able to follow the temperature dependence much to lower temperatures. That's why we worked on 2, 1, 4. So basically, the answer is yes, for 1, 2, 3, with oxygen doping alone, around 6.4, the same thing happens. But nobody has really carefully worked out because separation of NMR signal between 2-4 oxygen coordination, 3-4 oxygen coordination, and 4-4 oxygen coordination of chain site and copper 2 site, it's very difficult. That's why we went to calcium doping, because in 6.0, there's only one copper one side, and it's very easy to separate.
The zinc doping that you showed, 2% and 4%, it'd be kind of interesting if you look at much smaller zinc concentration, like a couple percent, because you might see that freezing temperature has increased under doping, but it's not changed to 1.19 or 0.2 or something.
Well, so below 12%, between 0 and 4, it doesn't change much. We have almost one more point on here. We know it doesn't really change.
Well,
but here, above 12%, we checked that 2% and 4% don't really show any difference. The reason we stopped at 2% is if we, can I address? If we go to too low zinc concentration, eventually we gain a superconducting fraction. That complicates intensity measurement because of Meissner shielding. That's why we have to go to relatively high zinc concentration.
USR measurements, the Cambridge measurements show that if you take a very small concentration of zinc,
uh-huh,
you increase the spin freezing temperature quite a bit in the underdog regime.
Oh, okay.
Now, not changing beyond
0.2. Well, so this corresponds to ridge onset of glassy slowing. Mu SR usually picks up anomaly at much lower temperature. For instance, in the case of neodymium. So this is the onset of wipeout, but mu SR freezing is around here. Of course, they are measuring dynamics, so they pick up at much higher temperature.
I think it would be interesting to do that anyway. But with respect to YGCL, 6.3,
So, you know, probably,
I may have talked about this before some years ago, that the correlation length is actually very big because of the bilayer.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you're not because of the wipeout effect, it may be just that T1 is too short for you to measure.
No, I measure T1.
At what temperature?
Well, around room temperature, it's just continuous effect. But I don't think T1 is continuously blowing up.
Can you get the spin correlation length out of that?
No, because as I said, since copper signal declines, while T1 and T2 gets shorter, so it, the temperature dependence measurement is awfully hard. That's why, as I said, I ended up working on 214.
Yes. Can I ask you one point? Just to follow this, Bob's example of stirring up controversies. This is the data being seen last week's issue of 123. And you can see that that's the NQR line. And both the chain site, coupler site, and frame site, coupler site, the widths turn on become much broader as you go below TC. That's 123. I have several, and there are quite a few NQR people, NMR people here. The question is that, do you guys see similar effects? Is this real?
Is this Grenoble result?
Yeah.
Yeah, so they blame me that I overlooked it 10 years ago.
They blame you. So if this is real, then it's very interesting to raise this question with the transport, because the question is that you see charge become much more inhomogeneous as you go below TC. Yet, the coherence length, or you know, the mean free paths are very kind of scattering rates getting to be much, the mean free paths get much longer. And the question is why this is. I mean, the things become more inhomogeneous and the mean free paths get much longer. And that, I mean, it relates with the problem of being in this conference for a long time, you know, why that's the case. The only way, trivially, I can think about is you have some sort of order if the distribution of charge is inhomogeneous. And I would like to hear experts in this audience commenting on this. But they see the good old white 123 with all the presumably clean sample.
I think I would say this is reasonably clean, but I wouldn't say this is really perfectly clean. Do you agree? Linus is about 300 kilohertz, so it's not that sharp. It's that what I'm saying is the Linus over here, it's reasonably sharp, but if you go with like Doug Bond sample, it should be like factor 2 narrower. So this is at first place is relatively disordered sample.
Okay, more questions? Let's take one more.